Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is called practical politics because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is, of course, rule-based politics, which is what you do at the voting booth. It's very, very rule-based and timeline-based, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, so on and so forth. And full-spectrum practical politics is engaging and taking out an opponent or a system or a corporation, so on and so forth, by any means necessary under the rules or under the laws, but never breaking the rules or never breaking the laws. But to understand anything, we first have to teach you practical politics, which is non-voting politics. The first basics are the art of staying on point or using a talking point and being able to say it over and over again to make your point, not arguing, just making a point. But this is an introduction, again, to Follow the White Rabbit, and Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. We had a very odd incident in America, and still do, but in America in 1998, right around that time, 97, 98, the Internet was basically owned by the racial struggle. I mean, it was outright owned. We were everywhere online. At the same time, a lot of energy was being channeled there. But something weird had happened in the society. In America, everyone around the world knows that you have a Bill of Rights and you have all these free speech privileges. Well, that's true. But it's not. You know, Nicholas Griffin from the British National Party made an interesting statement. He said, America has all kinds of free speech, but they don't use it. Well, that's not true. If you can get fired on the job for saying something, you don't have free speech. I mean, it doesn't really matter what it says in the Bill of Rights or the Constitution, so on and so forth. If you're saying it and getting fired, you don't have free speech. But from a revolutionary standpoint, from more obvious is better, in 1998, you had a new media going off that had totally free speech that everyone was using. To this day, no one says anything at their office because they're going to get fired. They get online and they rant about it. Well, believe it or not, there is no hate speech law you can't get around if you're wise. We've gotten around every single kind of closed society weird rule regarding speech, and it's very simple to do. All of our talking points now get around all kinds of free speech codes in Germany and whatnot. It's very simple. It's a matter of staying on message and having someone clever, like Bob, come up with something for the right time. Mr. Soros, I mentioned him in Eastern Europe, the Open Society Foundation. Well, they bought all these copying machines and they put them in colleges, they put them in universities, in basements, and they let unsupervised, or so they say. But kids were allowed to come in, people were allowed to come in and photocopy things and spread ideals around. Well, all that stuff was illegal. A lot of their ideals were illegal, but there's no way to police that. Well, they did a crackdown. They cracked down on some things, but they could never really crack down, because they didn't remove the copiers. So you interest, basically that situation really helped him. The more they crack down, or the more something becomes subversive, the more powerful it becomes. I'm always amused, and I would encourage you to go to YouTube and look up Nazi. Look how many posts some of these different Nazi things get. Nazism, of course, is very subversive. It's illegal in Germany. It's illegal to talk about. It's illegal, period. It's illegal to trade, old Nazi coins, old Nazi helmets. I mean, Yahoo people go to jail for that in Germany. But that just makes it more for some reason, people get attracted to that. It is the oldest rule in the book. In Mexico, a lot of people think America gun laws are too lax. Well, Mexican has the most ruthless gun laws on earth. Yeah, the Mexican gun laws on the books are more ruthless than anything in the Nordic countries. They're ruthless. Ruthless gun laws in Mexico. And you can go to Mexico and you can get all kinds of guns, rocket launchers, who knows what. Don't believe me? Go down there and try. Yeah, fly over to Mexico. You can buy whatever you want. They're all illegal, but you can still get it done. And by making it illegal, of course, it makes it more plentiful. It's an old law. And by the way, most of them don't come from America. No, on any gun bazaar, you'll find out that 80-90% of them are from somewhere else. Getting guns across the border from America ain't as easy as you think. It's probably a lot easier to get them from overseas. But again, if you have all kinds of weird laws on the books, it just makes stuff more attractive and easier to do. There's something about it. It's natural law or whatever. But we had a case in 98 where the internet was taking off, and the easy way to channel energy into a copier or into the internet because there is to basically start cracking down. We had a case where there's a crackdown. You're losing jobs for saying something, but yet you have free speech. Well, you don't have free speech. You only think you do. You know, white rabbits, like all rabbits, you got to be beat over the head with a carrot. They got to see things. The more obvious, the better. The worse is better. The more obvious is better. I mean, you can't get anything worse than not being able to say something on the job without getting fired. You know, so the more obvious is better. So believe it or not, I want it to crack down. Sure. I want it. Now, it's unconstitutional. Yes, it's nasty. It's wrong. A lot of people around the world would be upset. But if it's illegal to say something on the job, we might as well make it formal and so we can get to a solution. You see, by cracking down, they create a problem. That problem is going to get a lot bigger reaction than they think, and it's all going to be channeled online because that's the only outlet. And then there's going to be a solution. It's just that simple. I knew in 1998, or I had a good idea, that there was no way that they could control speech on the internet. There was no way. It's impossible. In fact, even with all the, just recently, over the past couple, 24 months, 36 months, China has more and more regulation on the internet, and they've become very good at it. But even as sophisticated as China is on regulating the internet, is not as easy as you think. There's always someone more clever. And in China, you know, you make something subversive, and it makes it that more attractive. It's just what it is. But a lot of times that helps their ideals. It did when it comes to copiers and putting out ideals in a closed society that was about to crash. It really helped the Open Society Foundation, George Soros' Open Society Foundation. It accelerated things. It accelerated the transfer of power in Eastern Europe because all the laws were silly, everything was silly. And in this country, we're dealing with something more interesting. We're dealing with a common sense of oppression among non-victims. You know, you got to channel that energy to get to a final solution. You got to get them to the point where they're going to move or they're going to act or whatever. But that was an interesting scenario. And to this day, you know, America, they now have it. Of course, if they crack down on speech, they could crack down on the internet. But now it is so wide and so deep. You know, the internet came out. It was like we're sitting in front of a puddle of information. Then someone, a meteor came from heaven and smashed into the puddle and made this big crack in the rock, and all this water starts seeping in. We found out underneath that puddle there's an ocean, and we don't know how deep it goes. There's some very weird stuff on the internet, of course, and all kinds of interesting stuff in regards to the racialist meeting and everything else. So we were in late 1998, and we had this big contradiction that's still there. You could say whatever you want, supposedly under law, but if you do it, you're going to get fired or they make your life miserable. Well, you don't have free speech, so you might as well make it formal. And the more obvious, the better. And there was also another scenario, too. I was sitting at my office that one day, surrounded by associates. And I had, Bob had a website then discussing his ideals, and he was putting together what I will call the mantra. He was putting it together, and he had it put together in a roundabout way. It was a similar type of post. That you could easily soundbite and make talking points from, whatever. I knew what he was up to, and I was reading his website simply because, like a lot of people, let me tell you a story offhand. I've never been to any type of racialist meeting. I've never been to any type of white nationalist meeting or Stormfront meetings or anything like that. But Bob went to a couple of them. And the back channel feedback was pretty entertaining for us. It was Bob's into practical politics. Practical politics is, of course, non-voting politics. And Bob worked for the CIA, whatnot, and it kind of scares some people. Is what the back channel talk was. No one really know what to think of him, other than obviously he's pretty smart. He's a Southern gentleman. But what they didn't understand was what he's telling them, what he can do, and what he can help them with. It was kind of funny to see that. I mean, no one really understands practical politics. You know, they think it's conventional politics. Well, it has nothing to do with apples. But it was kind of funny seeing that feedback channel. But Bob went to a couple of those, and he was on developing his ideals, developing his. He was going on the record. Obviously, if you're on a blog, you're going on the record. You're putting out yourself. You're putting out your ideals. Now he'd put out his ideals in a roundabout way, but never so explicitly and never so thoroughly. Like if you get on the untrained eye, you're going to get his ideals. You're going to get his type of thinking. What's great about his type of thinking, or what's unique, is that he's into practical politics. Someone like Bob has seen hundreds, if not thousands, of revolutions. So you're really getting the thinking of a revolutionary mind. Chairman Mao only saw one revolution and a handful of other different control struggles. Bob has seen all kinds of those in his life. He's won a lot, and he's lost a lot, and a lot he can't even talk about. I mean, the president's not even going to find out about stuff like that. It's just not how it works. But you're getting into that type of mindset. And so I immediately started reading it when he came online, and so did a lot of other people, a handful of other people, just to get into his mind. Obviously, if someone's good at what they do and you respect that, you want to understand what they're doing. But it was always kind of entertaining for me in the racialist movement that no one really understood that, or it scared them. Well, it is what it is. But one day I was reading it. And this was when he was developing his mantra, or maybe he already had a mantra in a roundabout way. It's similar to the one I'm going to read to you now. His thinking was similar. It wasn't as short. It wasn't as sweet. But it was similar. Africa for the Africans, Asia for the Asians, white countries for everybody. The Netherlands is more crowded than Japan. Belgium is more crowded than Taiwan. But no one says Japan or Taiwan will solve the race problem by bringing in millions of third worlders and assimilating and intermarrying with them. The words immigration, tolerance, and especially assimilation are being used to promote a program of genocide against the white race. Everybody says the final solution to the race problem is for every white country and only white countries to bring in the third world and assimilate and intermarry non-whites. All this immigration and intermarriage is for every white country and only white countries. This is genocide against the white race. Anti-racism is a code word for anti-white. That's a shortened version. But what was happening, what he had done is he in the post I read, he was articulating this. He was articulating this a handful of times in a different way. And one of them I had read out loud. And the place, you could hear a pin drop. And then it occurred to me that we were at this stage of our struggle in 1998 or whenever it was. It may have been after that, it may have been slightly before that, I can't remember the exact time. But when I was young, let me tell it to you this way. When I was about 12 years old, I was sitting in ground zero for a couple twisters that went through our neighborhood. And I got up one summer morning and looked out this little picture window in a ranch house we lived in. My family lived in. And it was a weird picture. To this day, it's ingrained in my mind. Everything was green. It was an eerie, beautiful green. I looked outside and I saw green. It was it looked dangerous, it looked dicey, but at the same time, it looked beautiful. And then I saw cracks of lightning, and a tree whizzed by, and you would not believe the destruction that came by after that. It was it was kind of funny. It's funny in hindsight. It's very scary, though. But that was the vision I had, is that someone's getting ready to get hit by a twister. Everyone in the office knew exactly what Bob's saying. When I just read you the mantra, what basically he's saying, what is saying to me is that, well, Darth Vader's already visited Lando. Darth Vader already has Han Solo. he's already came back for Luke Skywalker. He already has Princess Leia. And basically, he may even already have R2-D2. He's down to C-3PO, and he doesn't particularly care for Wookiees. Lando's got a meeting with the Sith Lord coming. And I don't know if you know anything about those meetings with the Sith Lord, but they never go that good for anybody. You know, they're not much of a meeting, and there's not much of a negotiation involved. That's what it occurred to everybody, that someone was in the type of trouble that you just don't want to be in. Someone's on the record, and you know, everyone's seen these weird events in Western civilization, that all these countries that overnight just opened up the floodgates to non-European immigration with no plan in place. You know, if you want a multiracial, there are two multiracial, multicultural societies that are doing quite well. People want to go to Singapore and Dubai, but neither one of them are democracies or republics. Neither one of them have given up posterity. And Singapore, the Chinese run things, and they work things out. They negotiate it. That's how all multiracial countries run. They're successfully negotiating. And the Chinese maintain posterity. You like what they do, or you negotiate it out, or you find the door. You know, in Dubai, you have some prince that does the same thing, but they work well. I mean, there is a type of people. You got about, you know, 20% of the people that want to live in New York, they want to live in Los Angeles, and they dig that stuff. Believe it or not, they're out there. Nationalists, you know, you got right now in India, you're going to have a 20% that want to live in the big cities, and they like multiculturalism. Believe it or not, they're going to like multiracialism. And then out of the 80%, you're going to have 30% of that are hardcore Indian nationalists over Hindu nationalists that want to cut their heads off. It's no different than every side in the world is like that. Why? Because you can fly around the world in an instant. But they didn't develop. They didn't take New York, London, Miami, and develop Singapore districts and Dubai districts for people that like that type of thing. They could have done some interesting things. They didn't give Africans a home. You know, many people believe, I won't say anything exact, but I have heard that in the Soviet archives, you know, everyone knows MLK was a communist agent and whatnot, that he thought he was getting his own country. You know, you'd go out and segregate it, and they'd just move him into a little country, and then, well, he got shot in the head. The next thing you know, in somewhere like America, you got a bunch of Latinos coming across the border. Well, if someone goes on the record, and someone goes on the record saying, we're going to target little white rabbits, we're going to wipe them out. They're not part of our order on this planet. We want to blend them out of existence. They develop all these social engineering schemes with that in mind. And everyone on this planet, everyone listening to this, has heard these crazy white people, and most of them are white, come out of these social engineering schools and say all kinds of ridiculous things. Well, someone had to design those schools. Someone had to finance it. So you have the idea, which is very weird. It's very, you know, you're either a genocidal freak or a pervert or some combination. Our enemy is generally both, you know. How are you going to force miscegenation? Well, who knows? Maybe they plan on chipping women or something. I don't know. It's not working. In any way, their numbers aren't working. And I'm going to go into a little more of their numbers. Their numbers have not been right in the history of their numbers. But that's what you do. But when they beat down the doors, you have all these Hispanics coming in. Well, if you're firing a weapon, it really doesn't matter what it is. A lot of times when this happens, you're not going to go on the dock for genociding white rabbits. What happens is you get an ethnic cleansing charge. In other words, you fire a weapon at little white rabbits, you run other ones over. You know, you got some little African and America rabbits sitting out there in Los Angeles. The next thing you know, they're getting run over. They have certain percentage displacement. They have to move, or they have a certain percentage get shot, getting riddled with gunfire, gang warfare. But if you're firing a weapon at white rabbits, well, that's not necessarily gang warfare anymore. That's an EC. That's an ethnic cleansing charge, something along those lines. Next thing you know, you're in full tribunals. Not only that, you have Martin Luther King getting shot in the head. Now, most white nationalists would say, or most people would say, well, we don't care about Africans, whatever. Well, if you care about taking down an enemy by any means necessary, that's something some parties would use in Europe, and especially to bring about a tribunal. A lot of the times that's lateral. You know, Saddam Hussein fires a weapon at Kurds, but he takes out another group first, and it's easier to get the charge. Once you get the charge, you might as well have killed all the Kurds. You might as well have killed every little white rabbit on the planet. you're done. International law is a simple hanging ceremony. I mean, if you're crazy enough to say it, you're crazy enough to build it on the record, you're crazy enough to fire it, you run someone over, you're done. You're owned. It is ruthless stuff. And then it occurred to me that someone not only has the goods, someone's already been negotiating on the goods. Someone's already got a lot of stuff. And they're in the D-Day. But most of the problems on this planet are because white rabbits don't have themselves a rabbit hole. They don't have any effective leadership, and we have all the weapons. It is this weird contradiction. You know, we sit across the top of the planet. We have all the, the whole entire top of the planet, but we don't have a home. We don't have a racial home. There's another group that has themselves a racial home, the little Jew rabbits, but they won't go there. No, they're not there. They're with us. They're in Venezuela. They're in China, but they're not in Israel. Very weird stuff going on in so-called Western civilization. Western civilization is, to me, just a gene pool. You know, if little white rabbits moved to Mars, then so-called Western civilization moved to Mars, you know. But it occurred to me when I first read the mantra, when I read that coming into form, that Bob was speaking for that Sith Lord. That's something that this planet doesn't know exists, but exists, and that someone's in trouble. And they're in the type of trouble you ain't walking away from. I don't care what happens. But that's good news. What I wanted to crack down to get things moving. But now of course demoralization is coming off. Now we're moving no matter what because the place is crashing down. And I'm going to go into Russia next, and we're going to start talking about Russia. The next few sessions, I'm going to work Russia into this discussion. But I wanted to talk about the match when I first saw that. The people I was sitting around were really, really frightened for people. You know, so if you wake up one morning in Western civilization, you see people jumping to their death, Hallmark names jumping to their death, you know what's coming. There is so much pressure going on, I'm assuming it's been happening for a while, and someone's in trouble. Because you can only imagine the type of archive some intelligence agencies has on these groups. I mean, you just can't go on record saying you're going to wipe out a gene pool, then do it, and then someone gets hurt. It's ruthless stuff. It is ruthless stuff. And there's parties on this planet that they're not going to back away if you're going after white rabbits, and they have you. In fact, there's parties on this planet against our enemies. They're not backing away no matter what. So I just wanted to go over that when I first saw the mantra. But these talking points, these particular messages, are good for a lot of different stuff, whether it be when I got the call up to do this, it came in a roundabout way, and I don't ask questions. My job is always to do and not to say. People that ask questions are saying something. But I assume it was for a reason. When I first read it, I know most of the guys on Bugs, they know Bob, but maybe they haven't heard all the stories. Well, a certain percentage of stories are true, and he can put the message out for some people. Some people that are good for our struggle, that know what's going on. But there's always a lot more going on with our struggle behind the scenes, because our stuff is always wide sky. And we'll talk about that with Russia coming up right now. Many people around the world have seen these so-called revolutions, the code revolutions, the rose revolutions. I think I mentioned the rose revolution before, you know, me a rose, you a rose, or me orange, you orange. But many of those aren't revolutions. I mean, another group comes to power, but if you have to buy something with that much money, it's never sustainable. When the Orange Revolution happened, within so many months, they were already using what I call control points. In other words, across the grid to control anything, you got to have these critical points, at least so many of them. And, you know, they were already in there, the other sides were taking them back because it wasn't organic. It was simply a divide and rule type thing, and someone bought someone and pulled someone into power, and then of course the U.S. government, State Department, so on and so forth, comes around showering money. The Rose Revolution in Georgia was similar type of thing. That type of thing is not sustainable. If someone calls it's almost like every one of these things is called a revolution, but it's not. what happened in Russia, and that's what we're going to be talking about. I'm going to have a Bob-style porch talk. I'm going to be talking in a roundabout way about different scenarios and whatnot with Russia. What we saw in Russia was never labeled revolution. Yeah, you never heard what Mr. Putin, Pooty Poot, as I call him, coming to power in Russia, his role to power, all the things that happened, a revolution. But it was probably the most critical since I graduated from high school or college. It was a very significant event for Western civilization, for the European tribes. In fact, I called it the beginning of the Third Revolution. The first revolution being the American, because it was against a simple ideal of these tyrannical bankers and so on. The second one being, happened in World War II, this concept of the third position, opposing everything. You know, it's just a mentality. But again, you're dealing with your same money side, the same money people. And of course, the Third Revolution is what started with Russia when they kicked out the oligarchs. And it was a process. But it's never once been called a revolution. The Orange Revolution gets called a revolution, but yet it's fallen apart. Russia every day strengthens, even in a downturn economy it strengthens. And the whole world, by the way, is going in a bucket. The whole world is experiencing problems. So everyone, if you're talking about Americans or Germans and whatnot, have yet to experience problems like they're seeing in other parts of the world, but we will. It's that time on the calendar. It's a time when change is going to happen, whether anyone likes it or not. But Russia, watching Russia was fascinating for me for many different reasons. Our enemy likes to do the same thing. They like to try to square circles. And one of their tactics is, and let me define our enemy for it. I call them the red hippopotamus. That's their god. It's chaos. It's everything upside down in your life. It's always trying to square the circle. It's always trying to do the impossible. In Anglosphere, it's hard to run across the Hebrews. But it's more than that. It's a mindset. But, in Anglosphere, in America, it's a who's who of Hebrews at the top. Around them, you will have traitors, white people that look like us that have no loyalty to us. And our enemy owns all traitors. Yeah, that red hippo owns all traitors, and all traitors he will always own. That's the mentality. If you've got a traitor to business, a traitor on any level whatsoever, it's almost cosmic. He owns all traitors anywhere in the world. If you got a traitor to his people in Africa, he's a pink rabbit. They own all traitors. But one thing he likes to do, he likes to, in Anglosphere, will surround himself with, insulate themselves with traitors. They insulate themselves with women, and they insulate themselves with majorities or minorities who live with us as minorities. What they call minorities, I don't call them that, but. The flaw in the strategy is always the women. And I'm going to get back to Anglosphere and what they did with social engineering. But in Russia, it's a similar type of thing. The oligarchs had a ton of traitors around them. And you were in an interesting standpoint because obviously all of Russia was on the line, believe it or not. Yeah, every inch of it was on the line. They were going to split the place up or destroy the place or whatever. And of course, they had a lot of women. And Russia has always utilized women vastly different than the social engineering stuff. In fact, if you go to Russia right now, and even if you look them up online, the youth movements, and they have women in all kinds of different critical points. They even have women in power points. What is a critical point? A critical point is any point in an organization or a group of organizations that can control or cause chaos at the blink of an eye. It is deceptive because it's not always obvious, but it is no less a critical point. A power point is something where you visually say, "Oh, that guy has a lot of power." For instance, in a Fortune 500 company, let's give a hallmark name, Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble is going to have several different critical points. You're not going to see those critical points, but they are critical. One person at that point, if he or she chooses, can cause chaos across a variety of different departments. You're also going to have PowerPoints. Now, your PowerPoints are obvious. It's the CEO, it's the executive vice president, it's someone making strategy, it's someone talking on CNBC. Most people think PowerPoints have power, but that's mostly visual. or maybe you realize that the director at your local agency, if he just slipped on a banana peel and fell out the window or something, the place would run a lot smoother. Some of those power heads, some of those figureheads aren't all they're cracked up to be. But your critical points are all the stability. It's part of the oligarchy that holds everything together. The critical points are pretty much everything, because if the critical points aren't holding together, you're not going to, the tail can move the head very quickly, and I would ask you to think about that, because most people look at an organization, they see some big figurehead, and they say he has a lot of power, and they can shake things up, they can hire people, they can plot strategy, they have a lot of what I call vertical power. Vertical power is what males do. Yeah, most men love vertical power. It's kick a rabbit, it's breathe some fire, yell at a rabbit. It's exert that male's type of power, deal steel at a rabbit. That's all vertical power. Lady rabbits, Aryan girl rabbits, they're not interested in vertical power. They're not interested in male type power. They do what I call run rabbits. For instance, the other evening, I had to get off the couch late at night and go to a grocery store and get something. Yeah, a lady rabbit made me do that. But she didn't make me do that. I went and did it and got home, and then actually in the parking lot I had to go back in and get something else and come back out and then go back home. And then when I got home, or basically I was out in the parking lot and I got a phone call saying, you got to go back in and get this. And I got home, and by the time I did all this, most people couldn't make me do that no matter what at 10 a.m. at night or 10 p.m. at night. But she did, and she ran a rabbit. Running a rabbit is the art of basically what women do to get what they want without causing a fight, causing commotion. It's an art form, and white women do it better than any other women, in my opinion, simply because race is real and it matters. But maybe you've seen that 12-year-old girl, the little 12-year-old girl who can babysit 7 kids. They can run rabbits. I don't know how they do it. Men want to kick them through the screen door. I know I do. I can't run a rabbit. Men cannot run rabbits. Women run rabbits. But anyways, I'm going to come back to this running rabbits. It's how, what I call it, men play hardball and women, by and large, 80% of them play lady ball. It's not an absolute thing. But there are Martha Stewarts that can play hardball, but most women have no interest in playing hardball. At the same time, they play lady ball very well. They are pure velvet. They'll create problems to get a reaction, to get a solution, and they don't even know what I just told them. Yeah, they do it every day. But those are all great, those are all things that is what I call latent power. June Cleaver, the June Cleavers, no one ever thought, the feminists always were sold the bill that they didn't have any power. Well, sure they did. They had ungodly power, but it was latent power. It was running rabbit power. It's non-vertical. It's horizontal or not what I call non-vertical. They run rabbits, and they will run a rabbit this way. They will run a rabbit that way. They will run you up the wall and upside down, but it's power. It takes a lot of power to get a male up and moving without having to threat violence. It is. It takes a lot of power to keep a bunch of kids busy or a bunch of adults busy in a department. There's different strategies and different tactics, and I'm going to come back to this, my ideals on it and how it develops. But what I say is, women like non-vertical things. They want to run rabbits. June Cleaver does not exercise power vertically. She doesn't have to. But at the same time, she has ungodly power. So anyways, looking at Russia, they stacked all these women. These oligarchs surrounded themselves with women at all these points. And there was various different reasons for that. Some of them were already smart and already there. but they got themselves into trouble. they got themselves into trouble very quickly. And of course, obviously, if you know someone was a KGB hand and they're dangerous and they're not a traitor, you can isolate them, you can throw them out to some extent. But they got their stuff together. And the next thing you know, in my opinion, they ran a textbook, what I call the textbook Cayenne Pokemon. If you have an oligarch, the oligarchs were not a true oligarchy. They didn't have some big power grid. There was a handful of guys at the top, surrounded by a bunch of traders, segmented over a bunch of different industries, all with a bunch of consolidated partners, with a bunch of women. They moved a bunch of women to the control point, and they had a bunch of slobs who were sitting there ticked off. They were trying to get rid of them, so on and so forth. And you had some violence that broke out and everything else. But, I mean, none of Putin's gang ever got caught shooting anybody or anything. But one thing they did that was dangerous is they moved women, Slavic women, Aryan girl rabbits, into too many powerful points, in my opinion, and or at or near a critical point. And they started throwing in jackrabbits. In other words, they were winking and nodding, in my opinion, and throwing them in there. And of course, you already had a few at the top who were loyal to the oligarchs, who thought they were loyal. The oligarchs thought they were loyal to, and Vladimir Putin would be one. And so what they did was they did the classic Cayenne Pokemon. You see, in this case, you're dealing with the oligarchs were by and large Hebrews. And anytime you have a top-light structure like that with a handful of people surrounded by traitors, not knowing who's their friend, having to keep control of all this, well, you're going to have a lot of fear. And of course, Hebrews tend to sit at the synagogue every week thinking people are out to get them, and then, you know, they wind up surprised when people are out to get them. They're natural. They fear. They're either on one end, you know, you got these egotistical maniacs who are very arrogant, like the neocons. Another minute, they're totally fearless. They're like schizophrenic. I mean, totally full of fear. They go from arrogant to full of fear and back to arrogant. I don't know how to figure it out, but they're very prone to fear. And so they popped they popped what I call a Cayenne Pokemon. And that's what I caught. Many of you guys, if you haven't read anything about revolutions, there's a simple kind of revolution called a FOCO. A FOCO revolution is what you saw in Cuba that brought in in power Fidel Castro. You know, he drives to power, he plants his flag. It's simple. It's what you see is what you get. A Cayenne Pokemon, it looks like a FOCO, but is what you don't see can kill you politically. What they did was they produced a couple false fronts, and you're getting my interpretation, by the way. I'm not going into all the ins and outs, but I'm giving you a broad overview at first, and I'm going to go back into some interesting things. But they produced a false front. In other words, the oligarchs thought they were being challenged by a handful of groups down near these critical points. Now, was it with these women? Was it these women, in my opinion? No. But they helped stage it. You know, staging is critical. It's where you're identifying your critical points and throwing your jacks. In other words, they stoked a lot of fear. They created a problem. And of course, the oligarchs could not see all their enemies. That's a big structure. They had all these government body structures left over. They couldn't see all their enemies. They could see a couple of them. All they knew is that someone was going to start coming after their power. So they created a problem. That problem, of course, elicited a normal reaction among these type of oligarchs, a fear. And they said, you know, we got to have. I'm assuming they were sold. They said, you know, we got to have someone to deal with this, to ferret this out, to see who's who, so we can consolidate our power. We can keep consolidating our power and go forward with our plans. And of course, that came up with a solution. That solution at the time was Putipoot, Vladimir Putin. Now, whether he presented himself, whether he was there in local, whether he was sold from an associate, which is what I think, I don't know. It really doesn't matter. I'm just putting this ideal out there. But the next thing you know, he's in power. Now, when he came to power, no one announced a revolution. Yeah, you didn't hear any revolution. But what was funny is the back talk, when he came to power, they had enough critical points, And of course, they had all these seething, big white KGB, ex-KGB jackrabbits that were ticked off at the oligarchs, ticked off at everything, waiting in the wings, ready to come back to work, so on and so forth. And so they had everything to go, but it wasn't a normal type of situation. They were ticked off. You did have a common sense of oppression among the Russians. Again, we had a common sense of oppression, you could say, among non-victims. I mean, they had power, and they exercised it. Now, they didn't shoot anybody, or they didn't caught shooting anybody. But anyways, he rolled the power overnight. No one really knew it, but they did. when he came into power, it was overnight. It was like the Sith Lord issuing those 888 codes across the stormtroopers, and they do a 180, and they start doing something totally different than what they're supposed to do. You're supposed to be helping out the Jedis. Well, we're not working for the Jedis anymore. We're working for the Sith Lord. He gave us that 888 code. And the next thing you know, the traitors are isolated and gone, and the oligarchs are on the run. I mean, they're running to London. They're running to Jerusalem. It was almost instantaneous. The moves, it was like lightning. But that original problem, I call that where a woman at or near a control point, I call that magenta lightning. They create that problem, which elicits a reaction from somewhere in the organization, so someone can come up with a solution. Now, you might, the first impression many would say, if they never heard of something like this being done, they would say, can it be that simple? Well, yes, if the time's right for it to be that simple. Now, obviously there's a move here, there's a move there, there's a lot of not saying it, just doing it. I mean, you're dealing with Mr. Putin is a former KGB officer, so they make a lot of that, and there's a lot to be made of it. But putting women at critical points, throwing them in, whether it be through crazy social engineering models or what they did in Russia, our enemy makes that same mistake time and time again, and they're very difficult. Most of them aren't traitors, even if you think they are. They're very difficult to blackmail and other things else. Even if you are, let me give you an example right in front of your face. Hillary wasn't supposed to be Secretary of State. They fought her to death over that, but she could give them a lot of problems. And she didn't hesitate to threaten that, I'm guessing. But that's kind of a funny example. They had to make her Secretary of State. Well, or someone did, or something happened, but use your imagination. But that was a totally comedy situation when they came to power. Now, the first thing he did when he came to power and they started fleeing at certain points of time, and it came in stages. Everyone knew something happened, but it wasn't, he has never, ever unveiled his hand. He lets other people do that for him in the structure or wherever. But of course, the first thing they started doing is what? What did they start doing? Well, they redid all the textbooks. Immediately, they had the textbooks, the Russian nationalist style textbooks, ready to go. Yeah, that's the first thing they did. Well, you want them under proactive measures. That's the first thing they did. And then they did a handful of other first things, but that was almost immediate. They transformed the education. They weren't going to allow them to demoralize the place. And even to this day, if you look up gay rights in Russia, there's a constant struggle. Gays are always sponsored by all these human rights groups all around the world to put up a struggle in Russia. Well, they're not going to allow that. They're not going to allow that energy in there. They're not going to allow that energy to flow because they realize that's a classic divide and rule demoralization technique. That's a classic conflict model. They're not going to let you run a conflict model in there. Have a gay, and then once they add in, the gays partner with certain so-called minorities. Next thing they know the deal because they were raised communist. Now, they're not communist now, but they have communist-style operating tactics, and they're not stupid. They're not Republicans. They're not your mommy and daddy's Republicans. The Republicans have done some of the dumbest things. I mean, they might be nice people. Some of them might be breathtakingly brilliant. But, they're not exactly a bunch of Sam Francis's. They're incredibly stupid, and they do stupid things over and over again expecting the same results. When I was just a young trooper, I remember the Republicans had that big Newt Gingrich-style revolution, and they all came into Washington. And they said, we're going to stay here 4 years, and we're going to do all this, and we're going to straighten everything out. Well, it was about the dumbest thing anyone ever heard. Now, they did some interesting things, but let me tell you, if you think you're ever going to straighten out any organization by staying a few years, you don't know anything about how governments work. You straighten organizations by holding down a network and expanding that network over control points and then getting a lot of people jobs and then straightening things out. Going in somewhere and thinking you're going to reorganize something or rearrange something, I've never once seen that work in my lifetime in any government anywhere. That's not how they operate. Governments don't fix systems. Systems fix governments. Eventually the whole thing collapses and then goes through some kind of radical deal. But that's funny stuff. Yeah, Republicans, I don't know. I don't know, but they don't have good operation tactics. They don't. They would have been better off putting down. They would have been better off going to school with Vladimir Putin in a Marxist society than going to going to school with their neocon buddies at Harvard and Yale, because they would have learned something about operating tactics. They get taken to school time and time again, and also a lot of them are just nice, honest conservatives, and you're not dealing with that in the Republican Party. You're definitely, everyone knew you weren't dealing with that in the Democratic Party. But when Russia, when he came into power, it was something unique. It was something was different overnight. I could see it. I could see something changed. The oligarchs didn't know it until it was too late. But although some of them did it first. One of the funniest things I've ever seen is when they hung the lettuce patch. Kartakovsky jumped out of there, and when Putin started putting the hammer to him. You see, Russia had all these gray areas of the law. In other words, there were no true laws. It meant what they wanted to mean. It came over from a communist-style society. But they had the Duma then, and there wasn't nothing illegal about buying politicians, per se. It was like some kind of gray area of the law about buying politicians. Well, they hung a big lettuce patch. When Kartakovsky left and there was some kind of scheme, they hung a big lettuce patch. They redid all the laws and you just couldn't walk in with suitcases full of money to buy the Duma. You couldn't do that anymore. Well, what's funny about these arrogant pink rabbits is the first thing they did is I don't know who it was, Rothschild or someone in London, immediately sent him back and said, they were in a fight for their lives with Russia. You see, if you can't control Russia, you don't have your order. You don't have anything. You certainly don't have a new world order without Russia. You ain't got it. You got to have all the Aryan tribes and all of them under your thumb, or at least in their mindset. And of course, you had, Wesley Clark and some of the neocons and Democrat, Republican neocons, whatever. They came out not much after 2000 and said Russia is a spoiler. Well, what are they a spoiler for? Use your imagination. But anyways, Kartakovsky came running back in there from London. He came running back in there and was sent back in there by, I believe it was Rothschild. You got to get back in there because your oil company and this and that. I don't think he wanted to go. He was told not to meddle in politics. He can meddle in business. You can own a business, but don't meddle in politics. Putty had laid down the law, and they hung out a lettuce patch. A lettuce patch is a lot of illegal. Is something clearly illegal. It's something you don't want to walk into. And there's lettuce patches all over the place, but they hung a clear one in front of the Duma. And he walked in, I don't know, with suitcases full of money or whatever, and they crucified him. They nailed him. They nailed him, and they put him in prison in Siberia next to a nuclear waste dump where he sits to this day. Some people think he's getting out. I don't know. They weaved him in velvet so tight, whatever, but they caught him red-handed. And, of course, there was all kinds of other laws. When you're dealing with a structure like that and the oligarchs, well, there's all kinds of laws they're probably breaking at that time that could be interpreted in any variety of different ways. But that is, that's full-spectrum practical politics. Right now with the Fortune 500 companies and the laws in somewhere like Anglosphere, the laws are wild. You start talking about Patriot Act. Use your imagination. You could do anything you chose to do if the conditions were right, but the conditions were right for Putin to crucify people. And he applied the law. And he applied the law ruthlessly, and he's in jail to this day. But that was very funny. When your big pink jackrabbits get thrown in jail forever out in the Siberian next to nuclear waste jump, it sends a message. It sends a ruthless message. But that's a broad overview of Russia. And a lot of these tactics are quite simple. But that was probably one of the biggest revolutions everyone saw, but no one saw it. You know, the Rose Revolution is falling to pieces. The Orange Revolution is already done. They're negotiated out. If you have to see, they didn't spend any money taking back Russia, believe it or not. Putin didn't spend any money. The place was being destroyed. All they did was effective. They played basically me a Russian rabbit, you a Russian rabbit, and took the place down. But that women at control points, I've seen them get hurt by this on way too many occasions. And I'm going to go into an observation that was made long, long ago. And I'm going to tell you in a roundabout way because I don't want to tell you anything exact. But I'm just trying to give you some ideals. Ideals on how to take power immediately in an organization and what we're seeing right now across the Western world. What happened in Russia, what I saw come about, convinced me on some things white women can do that they're... When it comes to non-vertical power, and I'm not talking about a lot of guys that would say women's spy. I'm not in the spy business. I don't know a lot about it. I mean, I do and I don't. But there's all this talk about women and honeypots and whatnot. You know, sex for secrets, that type of thing. Well, I'm sure that happens, but not as much as you think. Women can get whatever they want without doing a whole lot. That's non-vertical power. They're walking balls of latent power. Having them at a critical position across a control grid can cause disaster or chaos, or you can do anything you want with effective networking techniques, and they're already doing it. It's just you were at a time, you know, where women come into organizations in let's say America, you know, women were pulled in over feminism. And I'm going to go into a whole detailed story, an actual story. And they were pulled in over feminism, and they're sitting at, now all of a sudden they're all in there, and then they work their way up into these critical positions. They're not PowerPoints. You don't see them. They're not executive vice presidents or presidents or CEOs. Not that that means a whole lot. If you're at a critical point, if you're at a control point, some of those control points are actual choke points. You can do anything you choose to do if you choose to do it, if you choose to exercise power. And heaven forbid a handful of them get together, because that's usually what it takes, is more than one. But and there's nothing illegal about it. No, there's nothing illegal about exercising power, or as long as you don't break any rules. You know, there's nothing illegal about it. Most of you have had someone get you a job. Maybe some of you need someone to get you a job. Well, I'm going to tell you a very funny story. And I'm going to go into that next. And this is kind of just, I'm trying to tell it to you in a roundabout way. But I want you to use your imagination and think about what's in front of you and how many white women you see at control points or critical points. Not necessarily power points, although they're there now. I'm talking about control points and critical points, because when I mention white women are fearless, I mean that's an all or nothing phrase. I don't know whether it was a social engineering or whatnot, but I'm going to go into the exact story on how this type of thinking came about several years ago. I'll be back with you in a minute. So now I'd like to tell you a story. I'd like to tell you a story about young Mr. Q. Young Mr. Q was a very bright young man, and apparently he had worked for an agency, and he got out of the agency and got a very good offer from a group of investment companies run by the what we will call the Three Wise Men. And the Three Wise Men hired him for a particular reason. They hired him to kind of find a unique solution to a challenge that they had in front of them. You see, they wanted to get people jobs at different groups. And now I guess Mr. Q became an investment analyst for him. How could that be an investment? Well, that's a good investment for you to analyze. If you can get a friend job at the local fire department, that may be a great investment for you down the road. But anyways, he was hired as an investment analyst, and his job was to help get people jobs at various different corporations, entities, whatever. I don't know specifics, but that's irrelevant. One of the challenges they were having is that the traditional networks that they had operated in, we'll label them the old boys networks, had a kink in it. It wasn't bad or good. They just didn't know the fastest way around this kink. And that kink was that you now had all these women, Aryan girl rabbits, white women in these control points, at these critical points, that were hired in under women's rights and whatnot. And they knew that, you know, the glass is going to be half empty, but the glass is also going to be half full. Maybe there'll be a unique solution, whatever. And there's one particular instance, you know, they had these, I believe it was like five women, all these critical points, that could hire every single one of their guys or girls that they wanted to get in or whatever. And they were trying to get them resumes, and they were all very well qualified and whatnot. And this was, in this instance, I don't know whether it was a corporation or whatever, that's irrelevant. But young Mr. Q, that was his first assignment. And young Mr. Q analyzed it, and Mr. Q walked in and he presented it to the three wise men. And he said, well, you know, his theory was, and the three wise men's theory, that white women have to have a great deal of power because race is real, but they're not going to exercise it along the same pathway. They can't be men. You know, women's rights told them that you could be men. Well, you can't. But at the same time, there's some interesting things that they could do. So young Mr. Q made his presentation. He was going to keep it very simple. He just said, I'm going to do something non-traditional. I'm just going to approach them regularly. We're going to tell them what we're about, and we're going to keep it very very simple. And I'll go into that. I'll go into the direct approach. But the three wise men looked at him. Two of them nodded and said, yeah, well, I guess try it. We'll see what happens. I mean, we don't have any other great ideals. And definitely he was going to use a very non-traditional approach that they had never used before, but you're not dealing with men. And one of the wise men was, said, well, you know, maybe simple will be best. Two of them basically doubted it, and one of them didn't know. Mr. Q found out that these five women, they all hang out at this one local eatery bar, whatever, and they already have a little network to themselves, like most white women on the job. Yeah, if you go to any place that has a lot of white women, there's going to be a clique of them. You know, some of them will fight, some of them won't, but there'll be a clique of them that get along quite well. It's like anything else. At that time, there was a lot of pressure because there were a lot of men in other positions, so they were getting along very well. So, Mr. Q went up to these women at their place where they hang out and have afternoon, you know, after dinner, whatever, afternoon tea or whatever. And he went up and he sat down and introduced himself. He told them what he was about. He told them that he would make them an offer that they couldn't refuse. And, of course, they laughed because here's a young man and he's going to make them an offer that they couldn't refuse. He said, I'm going to teach you how to exercise power. And they got pretty quiet, and they said, Mr. Q, we don't have any power. And he says, oh, no, you got more power than anything on this planet. And he's like, you just never been taught how to exercise power. You see, you think you got to move up to achieve any of your objectives. You think you got to exercise power like male. He's like, no, you don't have to do that. He's like, you can do it. He's like, you don't understand, Mr. Q. These women says, we don't have any power. He's like, listen. He's like, I'd like each one of you to do this little drill here. We're going to go through a little exercise, and I'm going to show you what kind of power you have. And he gave each one of them a little notebook. There was five of them. He gave five of them each a little notebook, kind of like a little legal pad or something. And he gave each one of them a pen. He's like, on the first page, I would like you to write down everything you could do from your position right now to tomorrow morning to destroy your organization or company. And they kind of laughed. And they did the drill, and they wrote down all these things. And he's like, now I'd like you to turn the page over. He's like, I'd like you to write down everything you could start doing tomorrow morning to destroy your organization or company and not get caught. And they kind of laughed. They laughed pretty hard. They started writing things down, and that took a few minutes. And then he sat down and read over all their things, and he was shocked. They had thought of things that most men could never even dream of. But then again, if you've ever had a lady in your life that had it in for you, you know the story. But in reading over these things, they became shocked too, that they had a great deal of power that they could exercise if they chose to exercise it. So that kind of got their attention, and he went over his ideals, some of the ideals, not necessarily the same terminology I use, but the ideals that we're coming up with about non-vertical and vertical power. I gave you my terminology. His terminology wasn't his terminology. then, but that's the terminology I use now. He taught them about non-vertical and vertical power. He taught them about how that they exercise power by basically running rabbits, on how to use basic networking skills, this network that they already had from critical points to achieve objectives. And one of them wanted to make a lateral move into another position. One of them wanted to raise. One of them wanted to, she could play hardball. But four out of the five could play lady ball, and one of them could play hardball. And he gave them simple tactics and techniques that they already use. Problem, reaction, solution. He taught them how to demoralize a department. Yeah. How to do more. One of them was in human resources. He said, you know, you could hire a bad apple into this department that you want to demoralize. He gave them ideals and tactics, things that they already do and already know. He just gave them different ideals on how to keep it simple and how to achieve objectives without ever having to move anywhere but by concentrating on we's instead of the me's. And they already had a we together. They already had a network. They even had code words. You know, women always have code words for things. And so he taught them that. And he said, the only thing in return I want to do for helping you is if you so choose to, I would like you to look at these resumes for all these positions coming up. In other words, this woman in human resource had several positions to fill right now. And she could look at anyone's resume she wanted. And he said, you know, all my big jackrabbits, my big white jackrabbits here, and a couple of these female Aryan girl rabbits are very qualified, and I think they'd do a good job. And not only that, they could help your network too. In other words, they could come in, they could maybe be a part of your network, or at least not oppose your objectives, and you know, whatever. See what goes. And one girl there already had the girl in human resources getting her friend a job and at some other position. And so they, you know, I mean, every single one listening to this has had themselves or their parents. Maybe your dad was a fireman and he got someone a job, and that structure is broken down for males, but that structure was very much alive for women. For males, it was only still there. It's only still there in private organizations or if someone's got some connections and doesn't say it, just does it, you know. But that structure was very much alive for white women, very much alive. And they also, you know, he taught them basically they could achieve anything they want without breaking any rules. And he says, look at the upside. You girls are complaining about a glass ceiling, but there's a cement floor. I mean, no one can fire you. I mean, if they try to fire you, unless you do something blatant and break some rules, which you're not going to do, white women generally don't break rules. They're not running around killing people. They're not running around stealing things. I mean, they're pretty much law-abiding. I mean, if they weren't, they wouldn't be Aryan girl rabbits, and we'd have a whole other set of race issues, right? But he basically gave them all that. Very simple stuff, just putting ideals in their heads. And in return for this, they said that they would look at the resumes. And a few of the people that he had resumes for right there, they said, well, we could already get them in to interview them, whatever. You know, they're very well qualified. They're as qualified as anyone else. And basically put ideals in their heads. That's all he did. He all did was point out what I say, point out the obvious. And I'm going to cut off the story right here because this is this should be the third MP3. And what I'm going to do is the third and the fourth MP3 are going to go together. And this is the most important point I'm going to make with you. I just started this conversation. We're going to continue this conversation at the beginning of the next MP3. And this point I'm going to make to you, if you learn anything else, it's the most critical point I'm going to make. I'm going to make it on the next MP3 because I don't want this MP3 to go 2 hours. So I'm going to split it in half. Basically, we're going to do one lesson over two MP3s. But I'm going to end this with an entertaining story. I'm going to end this third MP3 with an entertaining story in Western civilization. It's probably one of the most critical stories in Western civilization. I didn't hear this until I was in my 20s. Yeah, I didn't hear this until I was already way beyond grade school, teenager, even in college. I was out of college before I heard this story. And it's one of the most famous stories in Western civilization that never gets told, in my opinion. There was a time in ancient Greece where there was a big white jackrabbit. He was getting old in age, and he was a philosopher. His name was Parmenides. And this big jackrabbit Parmenides would sit out and he would preach his gospel. He would preach his philosophy. He had a handful of poems, and that's about it. We don't really know a lot about him. But what we do know is that he would stand and preach his gospel all day in the square. But no one paid attention to him. Parmenides didn't have any students. Parmenides didn't have anyone that really liked him or paid attention to him. He's no big deal. He was just your average show philosopher in Greece at that time. And let's face it, there's a lot of competition among philosophers in Greece, in ancient Greece. But this white rabbit just sat out and he would just preach his. And one of his poems was like on nature or on the truth or something like that. You can look it up. I don't even know if I have his name correctly. Parmenides. You can look him up. You can look him up. But I don't even know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly in Greek. He's not that well known. Not a lot is known about his poems. But one day after all these years, he never found a student. One day, one little white rabbit pulled up. Yeah, he pulled up, sat back on his haunches, and started scribbling. One little white rabbit took down everything he had to say. One little white rabbit became his student. Parmenides only had one student to note. Parmenides only needed one student. That little white rabbit went on to set the world on fire. Yes, Parmenides, one student. Parmenides only had one student, and he went on to set the Western world and all the planet on fire. That little white rabbit's name was Plato. Most of you think that it takes all these people to do all this stuff. No, it doesn't. It only takes a handful. You only need one student. Parmenides only needed one student. He only needed a Plato, and that's all he was looking for. He knew the rules. And that's an important story in Western civilization. Most of you think that very few people ever change the world, when in fact it's the direct opposite. Very few ever do. Hopefully I made a point with you. And this is the end of the third MP3. And this will be continued at the beginning of the fourth. This is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Follow the White Rabbit, again, is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is practical because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is voting politics or rule-based politics. And the ultimate, of course, is full-spectrum practical politics, engaging and taking down an opponent, a system, by any means necessary, within the rules, within the law, but never breaking them. And this is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Thank you for listening.